Agarance.
Hi, Byron. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Our technical masters at Blogging Heads have instructed us to present ourselves as best as possible. I had a ceiling fan going behind me on one of the previous ones, and I kind of liked it, but they thought it was distracting. And I hear they thought you were kind of washed out in the last.
Yeah, they thought that I was backlit.
Yeah,
and I was
so,
backlit.
Well, you know, they don't put a whole lot of money into this.
That may be a surprise
to you. So, you know, they're getting what they pay for on this video. But nevertheless, I've tried to make my setting a little better, and I hope you have too.
I have, and hopefully this will satisfy them, and they won't have to do too much, you know, cropping or alterations or fiddling with a light.
So listen, we were going to start off today with the kind of amazing, astonishing fundraising by Ron Paul, the Republican candidate who reported that he had raised $5 million in the third quarter, the results that were over on September 30, which puts him way ahead of Mike Huckabee in fundraising,
right.
You know, in the ballpark with John McCain in fundraising.
Right.
And so the question is, and of course, Ron Paul is somewhere around 1 to 2% in the polls of the Republican field. So the question is, what does that mean? Why is he getting so much money? You got any ideas?
I suspect that it's because there is actually a segment of the Republican base that has turned against the war and wants to support someone who's going to go out there with a very strong anti-war position. I think that there's probably also a certain amount of general libertarian sentiment that he's tying into. And, you know, I feel like he's rather imported the Libertarian Party into the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I am a little surprised about it. I will say that I have written about Ron Paul occasionally, and whenever I do, I've never gotten more emails than I get when I write about Ron Paul. Remember there was a debate, I think it was a Republican debate in Columbia, South Carolina. Maybe it was Charleston. I can't remember. But it was the one where Ron Paul had basically said that the United States was attacked on September 11th because of United States policy, and Rudy Giuliani just jumped all over him.
Right.
So I talked to Paul after the debate and wrote a story because I thought that his answer was over the top myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I write this, and I just got a zillion emails from people very angry at, you know, what I had said about Dr. Paul. And so I get the sense that people who support Paul support him really intensely.
I think that's definitely the case. There's a very fervent base of support for him.
Yeah, and I do think that there are probably contributors to him who actually wouldn't otherwise be contributing to any Republicans.
Right.
So,
what do you think this means going forward, though? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, it means that he's secure in his position in this race. He's going to continue to be invited to all of the forums. He's going to continue to be part of the debates going forward. And do you feel like he acts as more of a useful foil for people like Giuliani, and that they get to attack him, that he acts as sort of the anti-war Democrat, if you will, for the field they get to attack internally in the debates?
Yeah, the question of the margin candidates is always, you know, it's a big deal in both fields, and it always is.
Right.
The thing that's interesting about him, maybe I'm wrong, but I doubt that there's been a marginal candidate other than a self-financed candidate who is sort of financially secure, because he has a very bare-bones campaign.
Right.
If he has $5 million cash in hand, I mean, he can stay in the race for, you know, as long as he wants to. So then the question is, if he's going to stay in the race for as long as he wants to, at some point do debate organizers start saying, well, we have to, you know, we'll have a cutoff point, that people who are above this point in the polls will be included in the debate,
right,
people who are below it will not be. I think he'll definitely make it till we get there.
Right, and then the question becomes, you know, what of Huckabee? I mean, he's, you know, the conservative base's favorite. You know,
he's kind of just the
sentimental favorite, and he raised, you know, $1 million. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, and he's not raised very much. I think he's only raised about $2.5 million in a whole year.
Yeah, I'm sure if Marcos Melitzas ran for president, he could raise that.
You've actually seen him speak. I think he's generally conceded to be the best speaker, just sort of, you know, judging oratorically, the best speaker in the Republican field. And everybody thought after he did surprisingly well, second in the Iowa straw poll, that he'd have a big boost. And these numbers show that he really didn't have a he got more this last quarter than the one before, but it wasn't a huge boost from Iowa. So it's still a question. I think a lot of people think he is kind of angling for vice president.
Yeah, I think he seems like the likeliest vice president candidate because he could work so well with Giuliani or with Romney, who seems to be the two main contenders at this point.
That's right. I think the other thing that was really kind of interesting about the Republican numbers is Romney, who got $10 million in contributions and then kicked in $8.5 million of his own.
Right.
And then he said that he reported that he had, I believe, $9 million in cash on hand. So he's got $9 million in cash on hand, and he has put $8.5 million into his campaign this last quarter. I mean, you can do the math. He would be virtually broke without his own contributions. And, of course, in the past, he's put, I can't remember, but a significant number of money, several million dollars into his campaign. So which means that up to this point, he has spent several million dollars more than he has raised. And is able to maintain his campaign at this pace, at this level, only because of the rather enormous, you know, checks that he's writing for his own campaign. And I don't think we've ever had a kind of hybrid candidate like that. We've either had a Steve Forbes or a Perot, or we've had guys who go out and raise money and, you know, live on what they raise. Right. Has there ever been anybody who's kind of combined them both? Because he's a powerful fundraiser, but he's also, you know, leveraging that big time with his own money.
Well, I think John Kerry lent himself a considerable sum of money in late 2003.
That's right.
And so on the Democratic side, you do have a situation where a candidate who ultimately wound up being the nominee lent himself a good deal of money during a moment where he was in a fundraising lull and he needed that money to compete.
Right.
So I don't think you've had it on the Republican side, though. And it does raise a question. I mean, if you look at what happened with Kerry in the end, you know, the question is, what does this mean in terms of the enthusiasm of the base for this individual? It seems like Romney has been able to successfully buy majorities in, or at least winning a lot of these different contests. And because he has the money, he can come in, and a lot of the Republican contests early on, these straw polls are set up so that you can... They're supposed to be bought. You're supposed to organize people and pay for their tickets and bus them in and all that stuff. So it really rewards people who have more money.
Well, that was the big deal about the Iowa straw poll that he had paid. Was it $35 you had to pay to get in?
Yeah.
And that he had bought zillions of tickets, and it clearly just mathematically...
You know, and he also bussed people in for the CPAC straw poll earlier in the year, and in South Carolina there was questions about this as well. And
he's ended up paying for people to come to these events and vote for somebody else. I think it's pretty clear, isn't it?
I'm sure some of them voted for other people, but
By the way,
but enough
I
of them have voted for him.
I think the last time I saw you was in Iowa at the straw poll, and I believe you had plans to sort of move to Iowa for some period of time.
I was just out there for 3 weeks. I think the last blogging heads I did, I sort of went over my Iowa sojourn, and I'll probably be going back for some chunk of the coming months, but, you know.
Oh, really? So you've come back with a deeper understanding of what's going on out there, right?
I believe so, yes. And okay, a deeper understanding of how little the things that we talk about on shows like this one make any kind of difference out there.
Well, you filed some very good stuff from out there, actually,
on your
blog, thegarants.com.
Yes, thegarants.com.
Exactly. Okay, now the next thing we're going to kind of segue into out of this Republican field was this meeting that was held in Utah recently of the Council for National Policy.
Right, which the very secretive council that shall not be named.
It's something that excites sort of tinfoil hat enthusiasm in some parts of the right, but it is a group of social conservatives who meet. And apparently at this meeting, there was a breakaway meeting of a smaller group of people in this Council for National Policy that included James Dobson of Focus on the Family and Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council and Richard Vigory. And some others. And the stories that came out of it were that these guys were so unhappy with the prospect of a Giuliani candidacy that they were looking into a third-party candidacy.
Right. Because they didn't want to have a nominee who was pro-choice and who was as tolerant of gay people as Giuliani has been.
Well, if you look, I mean, I suppose gay rights are part of it. If I don't know if you saw, Tony Perkins was on Hardball, I think, a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on, and also on was Representative Pete King, who was speaking on behalf of Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
But it became clear from Perkins, I mean, that it was, I mean, abortion was the whole reason for this. I mean, it was the total driver on this. And he made it clear that, you know, that since a pro-life platform had been part of the platform, Republican platform, for so many years, that there was no way you could expect social conservative voters to support a Giuliani candidacy. The question was, though, how many people would actually follow them, because I know people in the Giuliani camp think that the social conservatives are themselves significantly divided. And just because they have this meeting in Utah and start talking about a third party or sitting on their hands doesn't mean that a lot of voters are actually going to follow them out the door. And indeed, some of the names that got thrown around for third partyhood, like Alan Keyes or Roy Moore, are not, you know, serious considerations for a national candidacy. So, you know, it seems to me I don't think that they really have any place to go right now. The interesting thing on Hardball, which kind of supported things I've heard in other places, Pete King was trying to say, look, Giuliani supports the Hyde Amendment. You know, he would appoint conservative judges to the court. You know, all of these things. And Perkins was saying, well, those weren't always his position. And Pete King said, well, but they're his position now. And Perkins said, well, we just don't accept that. But then when the talk came to Mitt Romney, and Pete King said, well, look, Mitt Romney was pro-choice until just a few years ago. He's changed significantly on his position. Tony Perkins said, well, those are his positions now, meaning that he could possibly accept those. So I think what's going on is a phenomenon that's well known among pro-lifers, which is people who are strongly, strongly pro-life, who vote mainly on that topic, have been disappointed by a number of politicians in the past. They don't really trust any of them. But there's the other thing is, you don't have to trust this guy. You just have to feel that you've gotten him in a box so that he has to go along with you on the policy issues that matter to you. And they may think that about Romney, that Romney is perfectly
so this happy is all just a big power play.
To, exactly. So it doesn't matter what's in his heart of hearts or whether what he believed back then or now. It's just whether he feels like he has no other choice but to stick with you now. And I think that some social conservatives may come to that position on Romney.
I'm extremely skeptical that the social conservatives are going to be leaving the party and consolidating behind a third-party candidate.
No, they don't have anywhere to go.
If they do that, it will be demonstrated for once and for all how small their base of support is. If they are put to a vote nationally, and it's demonstrated to the entire American public that, you know, they can get 5% in a third party when they're supporting a third party, then I think it really undermines their power going forward. So they have a lot more power by threatening to leave every couple of years than by actually putting themselves to a vote.
What would they have to get with a third party candidate to give the opposite impression that people would say, hey, these are a force we have to contend with? How big would their support have to be?
I saw a poll recently showing that 27% of Republicans might support, or conservatives would support, a third-party candidate. I think they'd have to get something like over
20%. 20% of the Republican base or the electorate?
They would have to get definitely over 10% of the electorate.
Yeah, see,
I would say between
10
and 20%. It would have to be really significant, enough to really make a difference. I mean, 3%, you're Ralph Nader.
I do think that,
5%, you're a little bit better than Ralph Nader. I mean, and nobody's going to take you seriously, and you'll just be marginalized on the next cycle.
Yeah, this isn't really precise, but I think the pollsters basically say that, tell me if you've heard different, but between like 9 and 12 or 13% of the voters are single-issue voters on the issue of abortion, and that includes the people who are single-issue pro-choice. Among those single-issue voters, it probably breaks down 2-1 are pro-life, so we're talking, you know, maybe 6 to 8% of the electorate. Now, of those people who are single-issue voters, I mean, the bet that Giuliani is making, and he may lose, is that those voters also value national security so much, and they're going to view him as the best national security candidate, that they'll put aside their concerns on other things and vote for him. There might be some of those who do that. But even, I think, if you've got a full turnout of the people who are single-issue voters on the pro-life issue, you might not get a big enough vote on a third party to you know, I guess, hit that wow moment that you were talking about.
Yeah, it sounds to me from the numbers that you're putting forward that this is why they're just never going to leave. I mean, they don't have the numbers to leave and make a big enough splash where they're anything but a fringe group.
No.
And it would be a self-marginalizing act for them, and I don't see any reason that they'd want to do it. It's much better to threaten to leave and demand that people sort of pay obeisance and fealty to them.
Now, one side issue on this is the relation of Fred Thompson to the social conservatives.
Because right, and you wrote about this earlier this week, about how he told Sean Hannity that...
Exactly. A lot of people, a lot of social conservatives have looked forward to Fred Thompson as perhaps the candidate that they could really get behind. And I think that that's probably still the case, because no matter what the pundits say about Thompson, and the pundits all seem to think he's dead in the water... he's doing very, very well in the polls, and so if he's dead in the water, nobody has told the voters yet. But he has had this issue with James Dobson, head of Focus on the Family. Dobson, a few months ago, had said that Thompson was not a Christian, which apparently didn't sit well with Thompson. So the other night, Thompson and his wife, Jerry, appear on Hannity and Combs on Fox, and so Hannity brings up this Dobson stuff. And first of all, Thompson describes Dobson as, quote, a gentleman who has never met me, who has never talked to me. I've never talked to him on the phone. I did have one of his aides call me up and kind of apologize the first time he attacked me and said I wasn't a Christian. I don't know the gentleman. So anyway, he goes on in that light a little bit. And then Sean Hannity asks, he said, well, would you want to have a conversation with Dr. Dobson? Do you think that might help? And Thompson says, I don't particularly care to have a conversation with him. If he wants to call up and apologize again, that's okay with me, but I'm not going to dance to anybody's tune. Now, just kind of feeling out people about this in the past couple of days, I've gotten a pretty positive reaction from Republicans about this, even people who you would consider social conservatives. So I think this is there's kind of an interesting dynamic going on in which Thompson declares his... independence from somebody who's viewed as still viewed as a pretty important figure like Dobson.
Right. A kind of a sister soldiering on the right, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think people are kind of... a number of social conservatives can't quite figure out what it is that Dobson has against Thompson. I mean, Dobson has been a little bit over the top in his criticism of Thompson, and it doesn't make sense. I mean, you can... You know, you can say Thompson doesn't really light your fire, and you don't think he'd be the best candidate, but I don't know why... Dobson has gone after him in that way, but that's you know that's another interesting dynamic. You know we're talking about all about Republicans and the right today, but we're going to keep doing it. I guess I don't know why that happened, but
well, I think it's because I'm talking to you and I sort of asked. You know, I think it's also sort of interesting what's happening with them right now. The field is so confused on the right.
Well, yeah, and you've on the other side, we'll get to it later, but the other side, you have this kind of one juggernaut and then everything else, so you're right.
We could talk about her now.
Huh?
Or we could talk about her now.
Should we talk about her now?
Why
don't we do that? Because we've been talking about presidential politics, and we'll stick with presidential politics and go to Hillary Rodham Clinton, who was at, what, 53 in the latest Washington Post poll, is that the right number?
Yeah, I think once you have a lead of that magnitude, once you're at a majority, and it actually means something in a national poll. I recognize that Iowa is still basically a three-way tie and that there's a lot of ground game stuff that's going to happen there that's going to unfold in ways that we can't quite predict right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's a consolidation that's happening, and you saw that in the fundraising this quarter also. I mean, everyone said after the first quarter her donors are maxed out.
Yeah.
They donated the maximum. That was the low-hanging fruit. She has nowhere to go but down, and she's kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And
who is she getting now? She's obviously adding people, so who are they?
I think some of them are probably people who've also donated to Obama, who are hedging their bets at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she has made a major effort to get more women donors, and she probably mm-hmm. has more women donors than anybody else. Women are historically underrepresented as major donors, but, you know, there are networks of professional women that she's been tapping into and has mm-hmm. been targeting. So she's been trying to expand the pool. I mean, John Edwards was kind of caught with his reliance early on the trial lawyers, and then this quarter he's got many more smaller donors, which is good for him because then it will allow him to gather a greater amount in matching funds when he mm-hmm. Eventually gets the public matching funds in January.
Now, as the resident Iowan in Blogging Heads, now I believe the Real Clear Politics average of polls in Iowa has Clinton up by a couple or three percentage points, I think.
Yeah, it's, you know,
so she's doing
it's
better
still effectively a three-way tie because, you know, I mean, right. It's really hard to tell on the ground how that's all going to suss itself out.
Mm-hmm. But that that is actually an improvement for her in recent
weeks. It is an improvement for her, it is. But you have to remember that nobody started any kind of negative campaigning yet, that the real campaign is just finally getting going.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're going to be seeing a huge amount of negative campaigning from Obama. I don't think it's going to be his style.
Yeah, I know, but I mean,
to organize on the ground and around this message of coming together and changing.
But, you know, he's in the same place he was 9 months ago, though. I mean, doesn't he have to change something?
No, what Obama really needs to change is he needs to figure out a way to appeal to non-college educated voters, because if he can't even do that in Iowa, there's no way he can do it nationally in a general election context. Like, that's the single most important thing that he has to figure out how to do.
You know, it seems to me that every 4 years you have somebody come along who thinks they can run a really different kind of presidential campaign.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really work.
Yeah, I mean, Ron Brownstein wrote about this in the spring about, you know, the Democrats' poets versus their pragmatists, and there's always the insurgent candidate who appeals to the party's elites and the college-educated, and it's easier for them to raise money, which is why, because they're appealing to people who have more money to begin with. You know, if you're trying to raise money from college-educated people as opposed to trying to raise money from a combination of very wealthy people and the working class, you mm-hmm. know, it's actually easier to get large amounts of money from the college-educated.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you see? If the dynamic continues, perhaps in Iowa, Obama could easily lose Iowa and New Hampshire, and then probably South Carolina, right?
I'm in this sort of weird position where I'm having trouble seeing how any one of them wins Iowa, but I know that one of them is going to have to do it. But they've
yes,
all
one
really
of them will win.
One of them will win, you know, but they've all sort of blocked each other reasonably effectively so far. Uh-huh. South Carolina is an interesting case because Obama has done massive voter registration of African Americans out there and has
right.
done this tremendous organizing through the churches out there. And I think that South Carolina is going to be a real contest between Clinton and Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because of Obama's organizing on the ground there.
Mm-hmm.
What's most fascinating to me is the way Edwards is doing so poorly in South Carolina. It's the state where he has his highest negative ratings. And there's no evidence anymore that he has any additional benefits in the South as compared to Obama or Clinton,
right.
which is staggering, considering, you know, who he was the last election.
Well, he did win South Carolina in 2004.
Yeah.
Was that the only one he won? It was certainly the first one he won.
It was the first one he won.
Yeah, and a very large percentage of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina is black, like 51% or 50.
It's not 50.
Is it 40?
It's like 40.
It could be 40.
It's around 40.
Yeah. So it's really big. I think the interesting thing to me has been so far in the polls, at least, Hillary Rodham Clinton's support among blacks in South Carolina.
Right.
Which is
especially black women, older black women.
So it's been pretty significant. So I mean, I don't know, if she's consolidating, she's probably consolidating South Carolina too, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's impossible to predict how exactly South Carolina is going to go because there's going to be so many momentum effects coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire going into South Carolina, and then there's
right.
also Nevada wedged in there. However, I think that Obama's strength on the ground is going to continue to be a factor there, regardless of whatever kind of momentum effects you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
the question is, what happens with Edwards right now? I mean, Edwards was in this sort of interesting position where I thought he was actually kind of poised for a bit of a comeback, but his decision to take public financing, even though it's not a story in Iowa yet, it's not something people are really talking about out there as far as I'm hearing, you know, if people choose to make it into an issue to raise questions about his electability in a general election contest, I think that will be it could have a significant impact. And then the question becomes, who gets Edwards' support? Does that go to Obama, or does that go to Clinton? Does that go to, you know, Richardson, Biden?
Well, but isn't this a case, especially since he seems to be a much more emotional candidate this time around, isn't it the case that he can actually stay in, you know, at a fairly low level, he can stay in the race for quite a long time? And then if he does that, one of the things he does is deny Barack Obama kind of a clean shot at Hillary Clinton's. But I get the impression with Edwards that this time around, you know, it's very emotional for him and for his wife.
Yeah.
And I just don't see them kind of bowing to the practical reality really early on in this. Is that a crazy idea?
Well, I guess I sometimes I wonder what they're trying to do. I mean, is it better for Edwards if he I mean, the real position that nobody wants in Iowa is third. Second, you know, Obama can do with second, Clinton can do with second. The real position no one wants is third. And so if Edwards thinks he can come in first or second, with Obama also coming in first or second, then that creates, you know, a real a blow to the Clinton campaign and to her sense of inevitability. Because of the way the delegate counts are, there's always these sort of jumps from the actual voter preference numbers going into the caucuses to the delegate percentages coming out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe Edwards and Obama think that it would be easier for either one of them to run against the other than to run against Clinton. You know, so rather than, you know, creating a race where there's the Clinton and the anti-Clinton, they're more interested in a race where it's an Edwards-Obama kind of race, and you'll see a lot of the focus, the negative focus on Clinton.
Now let me ask you the exit question on this Democratic stuff. Obviously Clinton is in a huge lead now.
Nationally,
You know, some people will say, well, just remember Howard Dean. He was the front runner back
it's
then.
It's different.
On a scale of 1 to 10, as John McLaughlin would say, with 10 being, I guess, mathematical certainty, is there any chance that Hillary Clinton could fold like a deck of cards like Howard Dean could, and at some time in January or February we could be talking about how strong she seemed, and then when the votes came in, poof, she went away? Is there any chance that that could actually happen with her?
I think the only thing that can derail her campaign, there's not going to be an internal collapse. I mean, she doesn't make verbal gaffes in the same way that Howard Dean did. Her campaign is much more orderly than Howard Dean's campaign is. It's very methodical. She's got a lot of professionals working for her. You know, she's got Iowans on the ground. She's not going to be sending, you know, young kids from God only knows where around to, like, ask older Iowans to come out and caucus with the orange hats. It's, none of the campaigns are making Dean-like mistakes this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Not Obama's either, and not Edwards, although Edwards is probably closest to the one that might, now that Joe Tripi's increasingly important in it, because he, you know, of course, ran the last one. So, but for Clinton, it would have to be some kind of external event or some sort of major news story that would call into question her judgment or her values. And I think we can all, you know, imagine what such a story could look like. And I don't know that there
might it involve her husband.
Well, you know, we'd be lying if we did not say that we heard speculation and have been hearing speculation for several years, right?
Right.
I mean, you've heard stuff. I mean, everybody posits something, but nobody has anything that I've seen. Now, if something comes out, then there's a question. You know.
I think what we're saying is, just to say a little more openly, is that if there was some sort of girlfriend problem, that would put Mrs. Clinton in a really, really tough position of how to handle it, not only in her personal life, which would be, you know, a serious issue, but also in her campaign and how to handle it politically. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Right. And, you know, it's possible that there might be Republican candidates who have similar problems.
Yeah. I mean, well, look, Rudy Giuliani's personal life, I was talking to a prominent social conservative today who was, you know, giving me as good a rundown on Rudy Giuliani's personal life as any of his Democratic opponents could give you. So, look, that's going to, you know, if Newt Gingrich had gotten in, his personal life would have been a big deal. So, sure.
Dare I ask what you heard?
Huh?
Dare I ask what this man was telling you?
No. But, I mean, no.
Will you be publishing that in the pages of National Review?
It's a repeat of most of the things we already know. The rap against Giuliani, and you're going to see, you're going to hear it a lot more if he continues to do well.
And on the other hand, I will say the one thing about Clinton is, you know, I went to the Clinton Global Initiative in New York last week, and I think people are massively overestimating the loyalty the Democratic base has towards Bill Clinton and how much people adore him and how good he is, how much better he is than anybody else in Democratic politics.
People are overestimating that.
No, they're underestimating it.
They're underestimating it. Okay.
I think that he could have a really powerful impact in January if he went out to Iowa, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, reasonably...
I was hoping you were going to be counterintuitive there for a moment and say we were overestimating, but I understand what you're saying.
No, I actually think we're underestimating it. You know, he's able to bring values into the conversation about policy in a way that I don't think any of the present candidates are really able to do, including his wife, exactly the same kind of way. And watching him, I had the thought that I had the first time I saw Obama speaking, which is that these are the two men in politics who have the most organically in common stylistically. And I almost wish that Obama were running a different campaign, one that allowed him to be more Bill Clinton-esque rather than the one he's running right now.
Do you think Democrats view Bill Clinton, view it as an asset, as a good thing, because they think Bill Clinton might be kind of a co-president or at least a very close counselor who would play a big role in her presidency? Do you think they think that's going to happen, and B, think it would be a good thing?
I think he is a strategic advisor to her currently in the campaign.
Right.
You know, and it's quite an advisor to have. You know, he's done it twice and knows how to do it.
Yeah.
And none of the other candidates, I mean, you know.
But I mean, in the
David
president.
Axelrod versus Bill Clinton as your presidential counselor. I mean.
But I mean, in the White House, as she's actually a president making decisions every day, do you think they would want him there as part of the decision-making process?
I don't think so, and I think he said that he doesn't want to play that role either.
Right.
I think the polling data that came out recently.
Well, he said, I'll do whatever they ask me to do.
Yeah, and the polling data that came out a couple days ago in the Washington Post said that I felt fairly clearly that people saw him as a net asset to the campaign, and they and they felt that, you know, her presidency would be different from his, and I actually do think it would be different from his.
Mm-hmm. In what way, by the way?
Well, it's a very different period in time, and she strikes me as a politician who is amenable to shifting her position so as to work with constituency groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the constituency groups that exist in the Democratic Party today are very different from the ones that existed when Bill Clinton was elected. I think the progressive movement is much, much stronger. And I think you've seen that over the course of her campaign, that she has shifted from what had been a sort of hostile adversarial relationship with some of the blogs to really recognizing them and then standing up for MoveOn during this most recent controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clinton standing up for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know, they recognize where the power bases in the party are, and they will listen to people.
Well, I hate to venture into substance again, but do you think she would be tougher on defense and national security issues than he was?
I think it's very difficult to compare the two periods in time. They're very different. I mean, she's going to be inheriting this gigantic mess in Mesopotamia, and he happened to be elected during the one moment where we thought we'd suddenly been liberated from history and from having to care about international issues. And he wound up being quite tough, actually, you know. Not as tough as some people wanted when it came to, you know, intervening on behalf of Bosnian Muslims.
But I have the sense that she's tougher. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think she certainly comes across as a little more steely than he does, and that's probably because she's had to deal with a lot more sort of viciously personal attacks. And I think when you're a woman in politics, it just comes across differently. And so she sort of had to transcend herself. And so if sometimes you don't really see herself in things, it's because there's no way to be who she is without having transcended herself in a way.
Well, for whatever reason she would do it, I hope that would be the case should she end up being the president.
But I don't really know what toughness means from a specific foreign policy perspective. I mean, if we're looking at Iraq or Iran.
Well,
or,
you know what she said politically? When you're attacked, you have to deck your enemy. I thought that would be good in foreign policy. I hope she, if she's president, I hope she follows her, you know, she puts... Yeah.
I can't imagine that Al Gore would have been any different either, you know, in office in terms of decking the enemy after we were attacked on 9/11. I mean, I'm quite certain that, in fact, in some ways I felt like Bush had more leeway to wait before decking the enemy in terms of having a couple of months to wait before going into Afghanistan. Yeah, and the gap between the attack and going into Afghanistan, and I felt like if there had been a Democratic president at that period of time, you know, the Republican Congress would have been giving him holy hell about not responding quickly enough. And in fact, you know, it was a situation where we needed a couple of months to deliberate on how to respond properly. And I felt that we did respond well in Afghanistan, at least initially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we did need that time, I mean, to basically plan our attack.
Exactly. And I think a Democratic president, Al Gore, would not have been given the leeway to deliberate and to plan in a way that was necessary. And that would... anyway, so hopefully, if we do have a Democratic president, and, you know, knock on wood, we don't suffer anything again.
Yes.
But.
Well, knock on wood on that one. Now, our next... the next topic kind of comes out of the... the Hillary and women voters thing, which is, I will say this is one you added to our list, which is Ann Coulter and her latest statement about women voting. So I'll let you kind of take it away on that one.
Well, it's just, you know, Ann Coulter being Ann Coulter, and her she was interviewed for her new book, and she basically said something that she's been saying apparently for several years, which is that she feels that if women were not allowed to vote, there would never be another Democratic president. And this is sort of a personal fantasy of hers, a pipe dream of hers. And I just thought that this was sort of an outrageous statement. And we're in a time where everybody's making to-dos about outrageous statements, accusing other people of saying things that are over the line. It just, this particular statement struck me as the kind of thing that if you mailed it to a number of women voters, it would be outrageous enough to them that they would get themselves to the polls.
And then what would they do if you if they became outraged? That would they just not buy the book that they weren't going to buy anyway? I mean, what?
No,
would
they'd
they
vote.
Oh, they'd vote.
Yeah.
So they go vote for a Democrat, right?
Yeah, because of Ann Coulter.
I guess. I mean, do you think? I mean, we're going to talk about Rush Limbaugh next, and I think that you can put them both together in the sense that in any political contest, you know, if you want to hang. Whoever the most outrageous person is on the other side around your adversary's neck, right? So Republicans, I think, were quite successful in hanging MoveOn.org around the neck of Democrats.
Right.
And Democrats have tried many occasions with some success, but not as much, I think, in trying to hang Limbaugh around the necks of Republicans. And probably to a lesser extent Coulter, because while she is a best-selling author, she's not as big a figure as Limbaugh is, but
right, and she
you know,
doesn't.
Do you think
she's not a membership-based organization.
Huh?
She's not a membership-based organization. Like
well, yeah. Well, but do you think that moves any voters anyway? I mean, if you did make every woman voter in America aware that Ann Coulter had said this, do you think that would actually have any political effect?
Well, it depends on if you sent it out with pictures of Mitt Romney and her together.
And Mitt Romney up on the stage at CPAC.
Yeah, praising her. Who's been saying this for years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a radical statement. It's a truly radical statement. I mean, it's basically, you know, advocating for her own disenfranchisement. I know that she's a theatrical caricature and that she's a performer of sort of political outrageousness.
Well, I think she is a bit of a performer, and she does, you know, include an outrageous statement or two. In each of her books. In her last book, I think it was the thing about the widows of September 11th.
Yeah, no, she loves attacking women.
And, well, she's probably not alone in that. Women, you know.
No, I'm quite sure she's not alone.
Well,
lots
you know, I mean,
like
Jane Hampshire of Fire Dog Lake, the left blog, has, you know, been particularly rough on some women.
Well, she's been rough on NARAL, but that's mainly been on policy
well,
grounds.
Well, she's been...
strategic grounds.
Well, no, and she's extremely rough on virtually everybody, and if she were if Jane Hampshire were prominent enough, which she is not, she would be a very fine person to hang around the neck of whoever whatever Democrat she was supporting, and Republicans did that to some degree. Excuse me, the Lieberman forces did that to some degree.
Well, he tried
in the Connecticut race.
Yeah,
when she
it
actually
didn't work, and it
huh?
did. It, I mean, it embarrassed her. It was like a 2-day story. She took something down from her blog, and then ultimately Lamont still won. In that contest, and I think
he's the senator from Connecticut.
And Lieberman is the senator from Connecticut, but he left the Democratic Party.
Right.
But I think one of the things with Move On and with Limbaugh and all of this stuff is I don't know that it has a huge amount of electoral resonance, honestly. But I think, you know, if you were doing a campaign around trying to get women out to vote, and I think that if, you know, Hillary Rodham Clinton is the nominee, there will be a massive campaign around getting women out to vote.
Yeah.
And I think there already is.
Right,
So jazzing up that part of the base, trying to get this population of people who is voting at a lower level than their percent in the population out there, you know, you want to try whatever you can.
Anyway, it's a minor issue.
These are all little minor controversies. And frankly, the stuff with Rush Limbaugh and the phony soldier comment as well, I mean, it's not the kind of stuff that I particularly pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that if you're doing the politics of the outrage and then everyone is condemning everyone on the floor of the Senate, and it's just...
Yeah. Well, it is minor, but I do have one question to ask you about this Limbaugh thing. I've written about it at some length, and I didn't pay attention to it for the first few days of it, and I was working on another story for the magazine, and I didn't pay any attention at all to it. And then I got a call to be on television about it, ultimately, and so I thought, well, I guess I'll look into it. So I went and listened to everything, and I came to the conclusion that a reasonable person could say that Limbaugh was indeed referring to this news report about the phony soldiers and all that. So, I mean, that's my position on that. But the thing I wanted to ask you about is that Republicans did an extremely effective job of hanging Move On around the neck of Democrats and getting a, I believe, 72-25 vote in the Senate on this resolution. Now, so far, there's been talk about a resolution in the House and the Senate, but there hasn't been one. And the people I talk to, and maybe they don't know, maybe they don't have a good crystal ball, but the people I talk to seem to think that there won't be one. And I do detect a certain amount of anger in the lefty blogosphere that, I mean, obviously the big thing is Democrats have just been ineffective in trying to stop the war and get troops home faster. They've been ineffective at that. And now they can't even though they're in the majority, they can't even pass a resolution condemning Rush Limbaugh as payback for that one that got passed on MoveOn.org. So
I don't think it's fair to say that they can't pass a resolution. If nothing has been introduced, it's not fair to say that they can't pass a resolution.
Well, they're the majority in both houses.
Maybe they've decided tactically that they don't want to pass a resolution because it just validates him. And it just validates him, and it's they're playing from a different playbook. And, you know, they'd much rather focus people's attention on the president's veto of the S-CHIP legislation. And there's a massive organizing effort now to flip Republicans by October 18th to override that veto.
I understand that.
All of these groups Move On. And AFSCME and SEIU and all of these different groups are coming together, and the AFL and coming together to do this, you know, very targeted campaign on S-CHIP to get Republicans to flip on this. This is a Democratic priority, you know, and like that's the kind of thing I think people want to be focused on, the fact that the president has vetoed this health insurance bill for children.
Well, I think that Democrats can walk and chew gum at the same time. I'm not suggesting that they should.
Right, but I suspect nothing in recent events has made that a new opinion for you.
Huh?
I don't think that recent events have made that your sudden new opinion. I mean, I suspect you've thought that for a long time, right?
That they can walk and chew gum at the same time?
But they can't do it, right?
Well, I don't know why they can't do that. I mean, first of all, in the House, you know, the majority can do anything it wants.
Right.
You know, in the Senate it's harder, but my feeling is I don't see why they couldn't. Obviously, S-CHIP or children's health insurance is a bigger priority for Democrats in Congress than Rush Limbaugh is. There's no doubt about that, but I don't see why they can't do both. Like I said, just reading a few of the blogs, I've gotten the impression that there is some frustration with them for Republicans realizing that, you know, this is all political warfare, and when MoveOn.org makes what Republicans and a lot of people view as a tactical mistake, they can Republicans can capitalize on it, and then when Limbaugh makes one of these outrageous statements that he's made before, you know, the Democrats just either they're afraid or too timid or distracted or whatever, to go after it.
I don't think they're afraid or distracted. I don't think S-Trip is a distraction. I don't think the fight for that is a distraction, and I don't think the fight to try and change the president's course on the war is a distraction. I think it's the reason that they're in office. And if they decide that Rush Limbaugh doesn't matter, that he's not important enough to go after, then, you know, I mean, some people will be mad. They want tactical equality. They want an eye for an eye. But, you know, sometimes that's not wise. Sometimes you shouldn't act out of anger in that way. And, yes, Limbaugh said outrageous things. He has been saying outrageous things. That is his job, to say outrageous things. But I think if the Democrats decide that this is just not something that's going to be tactically useful for them, then it shouldn't be seen as a sign of weakness.
All right. Well, I think, you know, I kind of disagree with you on that, because I think tactically it probably would have been smart for their – they would have made their base happy to do this. And, of course, they could still do all the S-chip stuff leading
up to remember that the 18th. Bloggers are not the base. The bloggers are a small part of – a very vocal part of one segment of the base.
But it's not like the base is would be opposed to it, is it? I mean, would the base be angry that Democrats had condemned Limbaugh?
Probably not.
Okay. So anyway, we'll disagree on that one. I believe we have just dashed through our topics. And, you know, the next news, I think the biggest next news event is, in the race at least, the presidential race, is going to be the Republican debate in Dearborn, Michigan on Tuesday. It'll be the first debate that Fred Thompson takes part in. So we'll get to see him.
Yes, that will be
fun. And I'm planning to go. I don't know. Are you planning to go there?
No, I've decided I'm not going to cover debates.
Oh, well, you know, a number of people decide to not go to the debates, but I still find them useful going to
the debates. I'm sure they're useful, and it's fun, and you get to talk to people afterwards, and you get a certain amount of, there's a certain amount of source development that goes on, and there's a certain amount of the spin room stuff that's entertaining, and, you know, if you're writing a color piece or whatnot, I just feel like journalism has changed so much since the last cycle that at this point, the kind of magazine writing that, you know, people used to do coming out of debates is not, it's all done already within like 18 hours after the debate.
Well, that's right, and I cover them actually and just write for our website. So
yeah. Whereas I can just, you know, live blog it for the website as well, and so that's, you know, how we do these things now, right?
Yeah.
And to do the live blogging, then you don't really need to be there, because the reason to be there is if you're going to be writing some kind of like a longer narrative with color and details and so on. But like now you have the New York Times and their caucus blog, and so, you know, they flood the zone, and suddenly, you know, all the color is already used up, you know, within 6 hours of the event occurring. And so what are you supposed to do? You know, if you're writing a longer think piece, and you're, you know, if you're going there to the debate for part of, I think, reporting on a particular person for a longer story, I think it's still useful. But otherwise, journalism.
I guess you stay home and order a pizza. I think
political journalism has really changed since the last cycle. Oh, it's been really fascinating. You want to hear my little spiel on this?
Yes, please tell me.
Okay. Well, the thing I noticed is that, you know, it used to be the case that, you know, you would have the next day's story after a debate or an event, and then you would have and that story would tell you what happened. You'd have, you know, Dan Baltz tells you what happened at the debate, what was important. And then the next day you would have an analysis piece, or maybe you'd have an analysis piece at the same time. Now, the next day's story comes out, you know, within 3 hours of the event.
Right.
All of the sort of color and analytic stuff that used to get rolled into these longer weekly magazine pieces is dispersed onto blogs. And then you're having people who used to just do straight news reporting doing a lot more analysis as well for their websites. And so I feel like the certain kind of magazine story has been really its space has been really narrowed. So unless you know, there's room for really long form pieces, really in-depth pieces, and then it's just a lot of super quick stuff. But the sort of intermediate ground, I feel like, is disappearing. Do you feel that?
Well, I don't completely. I agree with you that the nature of this whole thing has changed, and it's all speeded up tremendously. I personally don't get anything out of what most people do as live blogging debates. I just don't get anything out of it because
I agree. Because you're watching
it on TV.
Exactly, and the transcript is there, and you don't even have to watch it as it's happening, because the whole thing will be on some, you know, YouTube clip or on the news site where you can just watch it at your leisure, you know, at 11 o'clock at night instead of at 7 or something.
So I think the only reason to to be there is for the spin room afterwards.
Right.
And, you know, and dealing with people beforehand. So I think it's a good idea, and I don't go to all of them at all,
right.
I think it's a good idea to show up occasionally.
No, absolutely, because it's about, you know, developing sources and sort of long-term relationships with people.
You know, it's also for quotes for the next day. I mean,
I'm
watching this debate. I'm trying, you know, as it goes on, I'm trying to think what is newsworthy out of what I'm hearing. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. And then I can actually ask people about it afterwards. And the thing I think is important, and I'll write a story for National Review. I don't blog it as it's happening. I'll write a story for the website for the next morning,
right.
And I really try to concentrate on telling them, giving them quotes and opinions and things that they didn't hear in the debate, because I figured anybody who's reading my story on National Review Online either has seen the debate or they've seen debates like it, and you know, they don't want a recap. So, you know, I think that's it's still valuable to go to them, although I realize that the very nature of changing of covering them has changed, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's my feeling about that.
Well, have fun when you go, and I will be interested to see what you come up with afterwards. And interested to see how Thompson performs as well.
Yeah, we'll see if there's any news.
Yeah, who goes after him? Does he go after anyone?
Yeah, it will be interesting, because the only time that I'm aware of that he's appeared on stage with any other candidate has been, I was actually there in Philadelphia. There was an event mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, and he spoke, and Mike Huckabee spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to audience members afterwards, and these are all well-connected political types from various states. There were, mm-hmm. you know, the attorney general of this state or a state senator from this state, heavy on the South and the Midwest, a group called ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the consensus among them was that Huckabee had just run rings around Thompson, had done much, much better than Thompson. So I think it's going to be interesting to see for the first time him up against all of them.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be really interesting to see that.
On the other hand, I think it might be a good, you know, it might be a good format for him, with a couple of good laconic put downs, and also he's going to be taller than everybody else, so I think that'll look good.
Yes, the tallness of Fred Thompson. I keep hearing about this, the legendary height.
Well, you'll get
his
to see
physical
it,
mass.
Right?
People keep talking about his physical mass as one of his greatest qualifiers.
Well, actually, you know, he's lost
like
a lot of weight.
Yeah, no, I know.
He's quite, and some people think he's lost too much weight, that he doesn't look robust enough.
Yeah, and then people said that he looks a little emaciated.
But he's. Yeah, I had a breakfast meeting with him a while back, and he had like egg white egg beaters and with vegetables and something. I mean, it was kind of a really healthy meal. I think if he had his druthers, he would have had, you know, a couple of eggs and bacon and a little sausage on the side, but none of that happened. So anyway, I think that that wraps up all of our. All of our stuff for today, so I guess what we'll do is say goodbye and then turn this thing off.
Sounds good.
Okay,
good chatting
go.
With you. Next time we'll pick some things to argue about.
Yeah, we should disagree more. We'll have, you know, a violent disagreement, which will make Bob Wright happy.
Yes, exactly. All right, take care.